This week on Your Western Context, we look into the reasoning behind Trudeau's trade escalations with the United States, a by-election with huge ramifications in BC, and overtaxation by Edmonton Council on businesses. Also, an unreported bombshell about Trudeau. What is the media not telling us? This is Western Context, episode 73, recorded Saturday, June 16th, 2018, Trading Bombshells. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us once again for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are in this week.
As we are every week, and it's good to be back again with lots of news going on, even in the middle of June when things are starting to get a little bit warmer and parliaments start to wind down a little bit. But we'll see that that is not indeed the case this week.
Indeed it is not. But if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast that aims to cut through the bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media, highlighting stories that you might not have heard before. And in doing so, we hope to provide you with all the information and context necessary to put you on the right side of the news. And that's what we've been doing each and every week for a better part of a year and a half now. So you ready to jump right in here with our Canada story?
Let's begin. What do you have for us?
Well, this week, you know, we had the conclusion of the G7 summit in Charleville, Quebec. And, you know, there was, of course, news that came out of that because, you know, Donald Trump was there. And every time Donald Trump is involved, there is going to be some form of news coming out of the venue where he was. And that's exactly what happened with the G7 summit in the following week this week. So the headline here reads, Trudeau stumbled into a trade war. That isn't all Trump's fault. So here's a summary of events since the conclusion of the G7 meeting in Quebec. President Trump left for Singapore, where he signed an agreement with North Korea. Justin Trudeau held a post-G7 press conference stating that, and I quote, Canada will not be pushed around. And now Donald Trump says that this statement that Justin Trudeau made will end up costing Canadians a lot of money. So you might be wondering how we got here. Well, back in on June 1st, it was announced that the U.S. was going to be expanding its tariffs on steel and aluminum to include Canada. And, you know, people were wondering, why would Trump do this? And, you know, it took a while for the media to get to this point. But, you know, as we talked about a couple weeks back, anyone who looked at the president's Twitter feed would see that what Trump was targeting at the time is our dairy sector. He basically wants fairer access to our dairy market. This was later exacerbated on Sunday by Trump trade advisor Peter Navarro saying, and I quote, there's a special place in hell for Justin Trudeau, given his press conference that he gave. Basically, what happened following the G7 meeting is Justin Trudeau gave a press conference saying Canada will not be pushed around. And we'll have some theories about why that might have happened a little bit later in this segment. But following this, it was later revealed that after the Singapore meeting, Navarro's job was to send a very strong signal of strength, and this was particularly important on the eve of an even more far important summit on Korea. And of course, this is, by this point in time, everyone should be familiar that Trump is a deal maker, and in the past, in the late 80s, he had a best-selling book called The Art of the Deal. So it's no secret that from a negotiating standpoint, you do want to negotiate from a position of strength, especially when you are going to meet North Korea. It just so happened that in this case, Canada happened to be the bystander. So what we can imagine in this case is that the Trump administration told advisor Peter Navarro to go on TV and say these words. So following this, both CTV and Global reported on this, and they reported that shoppers and visitors to the U.S. were going to start to boycott America. The CTV report ultimately read, scores of shoppers and travelers are mounting strikes against America's pocketbook by boycotting U.S. goods and trips to the States. The media even goes out of the way to report that someone in California has decided to book a trip to beautiful British Columbia, but that person also tweeted with the hashtag #FTariffs. And they're a strong supporter of the Democratic Party. So we must ask, and I don't think the media asked this, they must ask, are they supporting Canada or are they just standing against Trump, as most Democrats would in the United States? And as you're seeing here, we're slowly painting a picture, and the media painted this picture this week, and that was one of unanimity in Canada. This continued on into Parliament this week, because as Patrick said here, Parliament was still in session, and in Parliament, a motion unanimously passed that was introduced by the NDP. It called for the House to recognize our long-standing mutually beneficial trading relationship with the U.S., and to strongly oppose the illegitimate tariffs imposed on steel and aluminum, and to stand in solidarity with the Trudeau government's decision to impose retaliatory tariffs and remain united in support of the supply management system regulating Canada's dairy and poultry industry. Now, with this, the Conservatives supported this motion, and the Conservative Party even reaffirmed its support of Canada's supply management system, even though from an economic perspective, there is nothing conservative about a supply management system. The supply management system is basically a system that enforces dairy quotas and ensures that Canadian dairy farmers get paid at or above market value for their goods, even if that good isn't worth the market value. Supply management also prevents foreign producers from selling into Canada's dairy industry at a zero tariff rate, which I want you guys to remember for later on in this podcast, zero tariff value. And what's more with this, Maxime Bernier, who finished no more than 2% behind Andrew Scheer in last year's Conservative leadership race, was removed from the Conservative shadow cabinet this week. And he is one of those people who would like to see supply management dismantled as well. And there was some talk about whether or not this was related to a potential book chapter that he published on his website, but I think at this point it's safe to say it's to do with him standing against what the party is going for at this point in time.
That's right, and something that came up very, very heavily in the last conservative leadership race was Maxime Bernier's stance on supply management and saying that he was going to dismantle that. And one of the reasons why he didn't win was he was having trouble in his own home province of Quebec, and especially even in his own home ridings nearby in the southern townships, because that's where a lot of the big dairy farmers are made at. Based out of Quebec, and he wasn't able to win those ridings. They went heavily for Andrew Scheer, and Scheer just won by a little bit over Bernier. So it can be determined that supply management might have been what actually stopped Bernier from winning.
Yeah, and you know, when we were talking about the Conservative leadership race last year on this podcast, we did have to give our first primer of what supply management actually was, because at the time it was something new and to most people, unless you've studied economics, but it was a new concept to Canadians, and here we are a year later, this becoming a major issue in Canada. Now, this week, we also saw the media triumphantly reporting opinion polling that says that 72% of Canadians approve with how the government is handling the situation, and even goes out to highlight that 57% of Americans approve in how our government is handling this as well. So, as we're about to see, this speaks to the story that's not being told here. So far, most of the reporting has been on the emotional side of the spectrum, covering how Canada was wronged and how, you know, proposing this trade deal here without the layup in the media could ultimately change the discussion that was happening this week. Because I think we can all agree that most of what we've seen in the media this week, there has been on the emotional side and how Canada was wronged, how Canadians are feeling about this, how the government is feeling about this, and not too much about the actual economic at hand. So with that being said, think about these two questions. Has anyone ever asked this first question in the mainstream media or the political arena? Is our current trade deal with the United States fair? And let's be real here. Trade is complex and can't be distilled down to a 3-minute news segment or a briefing note for a minister. And the second question is, has anyone attempted to lay out the total amount of tariffs on each side? Brian Lilly attempted this on his blog, but nowhere else in the media has made this attempt to lay out the total number of tariffs that was going on here. So to answer both these questions in general, the answer is no, no one has done this. And by ignoring both of these questions, the media is not tackling the actual issue at hand here. Now, lost in this whole kerfuffle was CBC reporting on the sideline of the G7 meeting. At the G7 meeting, apparently Trump offered Trudeau a trade deal without the 5-year sunset clause that was initially holding the deal up. So what this 5-year sunset clause would have been would have basically said that at the end of 5 years, we would need to renegotiate this deal and we would need to bring it into the current economy of the day. Now, from an economic standpoint, that makes sense because the economy of 2018 is not like the economy of 2013 or the economy of 2009 when you look at it that way. So it makes sense to relook at these deals every 5 years. But when it comes to massive industrial investments that corporations like to make, 5 years is not a long enough time frame for them to invest with confidence. So this would have been a direct deal, a direct trade deal with the United States. And it's safe to say at this point, this deal is probably off the table. So let's look at how this happened. So first, Donald Trump left the G7 meeting early to head on to Singapore. The rest of the G7, Canada included, probably decided to have their stern press conference and state that Canada will not be pushed around after Trump left, since they all share the same globalist agenda, which Trump does not. Trump sees this and then tweets this after watching the press conference from Air Force One, presumably, and calling Justin Trudeau meek and mild this week. Then after this, Navarro is directed to go out onto the cable news networks and talk about the special place in hell for Justin Trudeau. And then the week ultimately begins with focusing on this high-flung emotion this week rather than actual trade talks. So at the end of the day, Canada should ultimately be engaging in free trade with the United States. I don't think there's anyone who would say that free trade is bad. And looking at the definition of free trade, that should ultimately mean zero tariff. And we should be attempting to get to this point. Canada also needs to have a plan to compete here if we're not successful in getting this trade deal. If our auto industry gets tariffed, it'll move to the United States, Michigan, and probably won't come back. We used to have a 16-point corporate tax rate advantage with the United States. Now we're about even, or maybe even have a disadvantage, depending on how you look at it. We could be looking at removing or at least loosening the supply management rules, removing red tape or reducing red tape for business startups, building more pipelines, getting that energy to Asia, figuring out a way to get energy east built, and finding a way to make maybe Northern Gateway happen again. And finally, on top of all this, the government could, at the back of their pocket, propose some personal tax cuts for everyday Canadians to make them be able to compete better in this new market. And if worse comes to worse, the government needs to be willing to make our economy more competitive here. And with this, Don Lenihan, formerly of the progressive think tank Canada 2020, said, in Trump's mind, the decision to waive the sunset clause had been a generous act of reconciliation, yet Trudeau publicly denigrated him just to score political points with Canadians. And we're seeing that in this emotional reporting this week and the poll that was done showing 72% of Canadians agree with the prime minister on this. So at the end of the day here, questions remain. Why didn't we hear about this new deal and instead get a press conference? We got that press conference saying we will not be pushed around. And why isn't the media asking the questions we highlighted previously about trade? These could include questions of fairness, supply management, or the progressive trade policy that the government has been pushing. And finally, is it worth risking trade by taking shots at Trump when a deal was supposedly in sight to raise your own political fortunes? And I think there's one thing we can end off with on this story, and that's that the next election platform is being written here, and that's nationalism by putting Canada first as an issue. It could be either trade or illegal immigration. It's just a question of any of the major parties, the Conservatives, the Liberals, or the NDP, realize it yet.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of questions to be asked about this, and especially in the stance that the government is taking on this. And I think you're absolutely right in the sense that they were actually going after Trump in an effort to score political points. And you can actually see this in certain polls that are being taken on Justin Trudeau. And we see this in the media, too. Everyone loves to have an enemy to go after because nothing unites a country faster than having an external enemy to go after. And Trump's a very easy target for Canadians because I think it's fair to say, no matter what political stripes you have, that Donald Trump is very unpopular in Canada, even before all of this. And it's just something that's real, and Trudeau is basically playing on that. But in the end, we have to ask ourselves, is that a good thing? Because we're no closer to getting a trade deal done with the United States. We have to remember that at least 70-80% of our trade exports goes to the United States to begin with. So they suddenly start tariffing more and more of our stuff. It's going to jack up the prices. It's going to put people out of jobs, and it's going to make people lose money up here. So a lot of people were laughing about Donald Trump's comment about what Trudeau's saying was going to cost Canadians a lot of money. But in the event, it could actually come true, too, and that's what's worrying.
Yeah, and I mean, when it comes down to auto productions, we know how devastating the 2009 recession was on the Canadian auto industry. And if those autos get tariffed, they're going to Michigan. And the way the U.S. is right now on a business competitive scale, they won't be coming back to Canada for a long time, if ever. And, you know, when you think about it, that would be a massive blow to the Canadian economy. And I don't think there's anywhere that said that this week in the mainstream media.
No, that's true. And they were even talking about Ontario with standing with Trudeau on against Trump on this. Even Doug Ford, he's saying that he's working with the government to try and secure a fair deal for Ontario, because he knows that if there's no trade deal with this, Ontario is actually the economy that's worst hit out of all of Canadian provinces. So I think he knows that there's something very serious going on, and we'll just have to see what happens, because as we know, a week is a long time in politics, and something could happen in that next week, of course.
Yeah, and I mean, we'll just go back to the retaliatory measures before we move on and highlight once again that our GDP is about $1.5 trillion U.S. value compared to the Americans' $18 trillion. So when you're fighting with that amount, you know, it's really a symbolic show at that point. And you need to be asking, is that the smart move to be doing when all of this, all these potential deals, autos and oil and all the goods that flow back and forth between the U.S. could potentially be in peril. So it's definitely going to be an interesting few weeks. What do we got for B.C.?
All right, so we're going to move from the national story down to B.C., and this is something that's going to happen that's very local but actually has implications for the entire province. So Nanaimo NDP MLA Leonard Krogh is going to be running for mayor of Nanaimo in the municipal election in October. So we've mentioned a little bit in the past about the dysfunctional city council of Nanaimo, and many people believe that the longtime NDP MLA might actually be the one to right the ship. Now, for the past 2 years, Nanaimo City Hall has been racked by infighting. Councillors publicly, not physically, but with words, fighting each other and trying to stop other people's projects from going forward. There's also a lawsuit that the city filed against the mayor, Bill McKay. You have to think, well, if that can be pretty bad if the actual city itself is filing a lawsuit against the mayor. There's also been lots of investigations by RCMP and special prosecutors into corruption, and there's also been departures of over three dozen city staff. So certainly the city could use some stronger leadership than what they have right now, and Krogh believes that he's the one to fix his city. Now, Krogh was first elected in 1991 under Mike Harcourt's NDP government as a backbencher in Parksville-Qualicum, but he was narrowly defeated in 1996 as the BC Liberals were starting to gain steam. Now, he failed to win in 1998 and 2001, but he was next elected as the NDP MLA for his hometown of Nanaimo in 2005, and he's served there ever since. Despite being elected since 2005 and having prior experience in the party, Premier John Horgan passed over Krogh to be a cabinet minister. So it's this snub and watching the antics of the Nanaimo Council that has likely pushed Krogh into running for mayor. Now, in a rousing speech to more than 200 people at a hotel in Nanaimo, Krogh said in his more than 30 years living in the city, he's never seen it suffer through what it has under the term of this current council. He said, "If the city was in great shape, I wouldn't even thought about doing it. But when you have all these people asking you and your city is in terrible shape and people want you to come and lead the charge to fix it, you've got a choice to make. I'm taking up the challenge." So ahead of the official announcements, there was a lot of speculation about whether Krogh would run and whether he would actually accept it. And his leader, John Horgan, wished the MLA the best in a potential run. He said, quote, "There's been a long-standing challenge in the city, and Leonard believes, and many, many, many people believe, that he is the best person to address that." Horgan said this during a news conference in Grand Forks, B.C. Now, Croak will stay on as an MLA through the fall, and this will be pushing a potential by-election to spring 2019. Croak said that he will continue to serve as MLA throughout the summer and during the municipal campaign. However, he's made quite clear that he will stop taking government paycheck once the campaign officially begins in September, and that he would resign his seat quite quickly if his mayoral bid is successful. And given that there's not too much opposition to that so far, it's looking like it might already be successful. So you have to think, well, why are we talking about this one MP from Vancouver Island, and what's this going to do? Well, we have to remember that there's a razor-thin majority that the Green-supported NDP government has, and any changes to the legislative landscape is big news, and Krogh's resignation triggering a by-election is definitely big news. Now, if the Liberals managed to win this seat from the NDP, it would give them a total of 43 seats, with the NDP reduced to 40 and the Greens at 3. Meaning that the former Liberal-turned-neutral Speaker Darrell Plaikas would be the deciding vote on anything when it comes to either budgets or confidence votes or anything at all, really. And that ultimately could cause an election because it would create quite the dysfunctional legislature. And that would really have wide-reaching implications for the people of BC because you have to remember from our story last week on episode 72, that the NDP are conducting their preparations for the fall referendum on electoral reform. And if an early election is triggered, it would still be held under the previous first-past-the-post system. So under the referendum law, the earliest any pro-rep election could be held is 2021. Now, Liberal leader Andrew Wilkinson thanked Croak for his service to BC and wished him the best in his run for mayor. Wilkinson said in a statement, Mr. Croak and Premier Horgan know what's at stake. With an unstable minority government propped up by three Green MLAs in the legislature, the implications of this by-election are significant for the entire province. We look forward to offering the voters of Nanaimo a compelling choice in the by-election whenever it comes. Now, of course, the Liberals would have to sell a pretty convincing, compelling choice to win the Nanaimo by-election. And that's a pretty tall order, because Nanaimo is considered a solid NDP seat. This was easily won by Croak in last year's general election, and indeed every election since 2005. Croak scooped 46% of the votes, and he beat the second place Liberal candidate by more than 3,800 votes. And overall, the NDP has won 13 of the last 15 elections in Nanaimo, including the last four in a row. However, governing parties historically perform terrible in by-elections. Over the last 37 years, the governing party's record in provincial by-elections is just 2 wins and 22 losses. And those two lonely government victories, by the way, were of course both won by Christy Clark, who was the premier on both occasions, once in a by-election, taking over Gordon Campbell's old seat in Vancouver Point Grey after she was named leader, and then, of course, after losing in the 2013 election to now Attorney General and neutral arbiter of electoral reform, David Eby. She also then won in a by-election in Kelowna to get back into the legislature.
So what we're looking at is effectively, potentially, a power-shifting scenario here, though it would still be 43-43, and we'd be back to that gray area, depending, ensuring that the speaker would have more of a role to play in this regard. But from the history, it sounds as though it might actually be a tall order for this seat to go anything but NDP.
That's right. It has gone Liberal in the past, of course, in the by-election in 1998, back when Glenn Clark's NDP government was on the decline, and then, of course, in the 2001 election, when every seat in the province except two in Vancouver went to the Liberals. So it might be a bit of a tall order, especially given the Vancouver Island's Green shift in the past election, where three Green seats ended up being elected. But we'll have to see how this happens in the near future, because if there is a resignation, Liberals win the seat, that could be game over for this minority government.
And I'm going to ask this question. Has anyone in the media postulated that this might happen?
Well, there's been a few postulations about that. Generally, are the usual suspects out of the Vancouver Province and Vancouver Sun in Smith and Shaw. But other than that, no one else has been talking about it whatsoever. So it's going to be interesting to see how this goes in the coming days. We'll have to see how the election turns out with in regards to the Nanaimo mayoral race. We're going to have to see how the by-election, if it's going to get called, and of course, we'll have to see how the electoral referendum turns out in November. So we'll be having more news of this as we hear more about it, of course.
And this should just stand as a reminder to everyone that minority governments, as much as Premier John Horgan might like everyone to believe, they are definitely not strong and stable, because as we're seeing here, this could potentially be wobbling the foundation of this minority government that you have in BC. So
indeed.
All right, so before we move on to our next story, I'll just take a moment here to remind everyone about this podcast's Patreon account, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext. If you want to support our podcast monetarily, you can do that via Patreon. We offer three tiers of support for $2 a month. You effectively are paying the price of a cup of coffee, and you help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, or the price of a sandwich, you continue to help us to do that. And you can also have your name read out on the show if you want. And for $10 a month, you become a Western Context insider, you get an insight into our work, and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the week. And when we reach $25 a month in contributions, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide our own opinion on where affairs may be headed next. And at $50 a month, you can expect online town halls hosted every quarters, and topics of discussion will include the news of the month, the state of the media, and your questions. So you can find out more of that at patreon.com/westerncontext or at westerncontext.ca/support. All right, moving on to our Alberta story now. So this one is more of a local story geared towards Edmonton in general, but it has ramifications for all municipalities in Canada. So a business group urges City Hall to put the brakes on rising property taxes. Now, Dr. Morali, who is a chiropractor in Hampton Landing, 2 years ago paid property taxes that were under $200,000. Now in 2018, they are north of $300,000. RBC Plaza, north of Dr. Morali's office, paid just under $65,000 in property taxes in 2016. But in 2018, you might be wondering what that went up to. $127,153. Now, with this, Philip Starkman of Ben Starkman Realty says he is so strongly opposed to putting any money to work in Edmonton because you can't make it work. He also feels like these decisions were made by people who never had to manage payroll, nor do they understand business. Councillor Mike Nicol brought this idea up before in the 2018 budget, calling it the Edmonton disadvantage, noting that we aren't compatible with the surrounding areas, even Calgary. So because of this, a new group has been created in Edmonton called Prosperity Edmonton. The group aims to bring awareness to the rising property taxes in Edmonton. Now you might be wondering, why are they doing this? Well, because between 2006 and 2016, the number of businesses in Edmonton grew by just 11%, while the commercial tax burden increased by 124% over that same 10-year period. During this time under Mayor Stephen Mandel and Don Iveson, the city's operational budget more than doubled, and Don Iveson points out to the need to repair roads, which are still crumbling if you drive around Edmonton, sidewalks, and building out the LRT. Through this, commercial property taxes are 17% higher in Edmonton than they are in Calgary. The current city council is ultimately seeking more money from different levels of government to build infrastructure projects such as the LRT and the Anthony Hende Drive expansion. The southwest expansion of Anthony Hende was announced this week, and it will be widened by one lane in each direction next year, starting for a price tag of $100 million. Don Iveson this week called widening roads a money pit, and he feels the key is better public transit, such as the LRT. So even though the Hende expansion will be led by the provincial government here, we can see the mayor's predisposition for city-based transit. And as we all know, a portion of these new LRT lines does indeed come from the city budget, which can be linked to the increase in prices at City Hall. Prosperity Edmonton is ultimately starting with a collaborative model here. They aim to help City Council reduce spending, reduce red tape, and decrease approval times for businesses to get started to help them to grow and succeed. Now, we hear about tax competitiveness all the time at the federal and provincial level, but not often at the city level, and this is really important here because most of the population is in cities, and that's where the jobs are. So it's really important for a city to be competitive on the tax level, just as it is for our provincial and federal governments here as well. So with that being said, I think we can all look at this model and see that, okay, maybe there might be something that can be done with taxes in Edmonton to make it a little bit more competitive and edge it out of that recovery period that we're in currently following the last recession.
Yeah, and it just goes to show that this is another government that doesn't have a revenue problem. They have a spending problem, because when it comes down to it, taxes are the main way that a municipal city is able to gain funds from their constituents. And the only way that they can actually gain that money is through those taxes. So, of course, if they end up spending more and more money, they have to keep raising the taxes. But that also cuts into competitiveness, as you said, because just having 65,000 in property taxes 2 years ago and then having that almost double in 2 years, that's quite a large amount. And the fact that there's not as many new businesses being created is worrisome for the city, because it means that there's more that's having to be going into the taxes because of increased spending, but that means there's not too much extra ways to get the revenue in. So it means that, once again, prices are going to be raised because of this.
Yeah, and I mean, you see city council most often resort to the property tax increase because it is not possible in Canada for as municipal government to run a deficit like the provincial and federal governments are. That's just not possible the way the municipalities are set up. So they always resort to the power of taxes to increase their spending and expand services rather than looking for means of optimization. So
that's right. We saw that in BC just recently, where a lot of municipalities are going to have to raise their taxes on properties and other things as well because of the BC government eliminating the MSP premium, which is the employer payroll. So a lot of the taxes are going up for that reason as well. So we're seeing this all across, not just in Alberta, but also in BC, where taxes are going up because of things that are happening. But in this case, in Edmonton, it seems to be because they're spending a lot of the money on extra projects, whereas in BC, it's because of the provincial government.
All right. So what do we got for our firing line this week?
So our firing line this week actually comes from Brian Lilly, who we mentioned earlier in the podcast, and his blog post actually read, "Don't believe Canada's media on Me Too stories." So this is a fairly sensationalist headline in itself there, but in it, he actually writes a fairly good article. But we'll give you a bit of background before we get into that. So over the last half year, we've heard a lot about the hashtag MeToo movement in Canadian politics, and this has seen many male politicians resign in disgrace, in some cases from just an accusation without proof. Now, Patrick Brown would likely be the Premier of Ontario right now had accusations not surfaced last March. Liberal MPs Kent Hare, Hunter Tutu, Darshan Kang, and NDP MP Aaron Weir, Nova Scotia PC leader Jamie Bailey, Ontario PC President Rick Dykstra, and a lot of others all resigned in various ways due to allegations. In 2014, Liberal MPs Massimo Pacetti and Scott Andrews were suspended by Justin Trudeau after two female NDP MPs leveled complaints against them, and eventually the pair voluntarily resigned from the Liberal caucus permanently. So back in late January, amidst all the resignations, a reporter asked Prime Minister Justin Trudeau if the same standards that applied to everyone in his party applied to him as well. He candidly replied, "The standard applies to everyone." In that interview, he also said that it doesn't matter how old the allegations are, saying that there is no context in which someone does not have responsibility for things they have done in the past. Now, when asked by the reporter, "As you look back into your own career, is there a chance at some point that your actions might not have been construed the way they were intended?" Justin Trudeau responded, "I don't think so. I've been very, very careful all my life to be thoughtful, to be respectful of people's space and people's headspace as well." So despite this statement of confidence in his own actions, Trudeau said that he is subject to the same zero tolerance policy that he applies to everyone else. So the media at the time, back in January and February when all this was going on, seemed to think that there would be other high-profile people named. We haven't really seen too many of those since then, but it's worth looking back and looking at what some of the journalists were talking about, because oftentimes journalists will uncover stories that they aren't able to publish, but they still know about it. So you kind of have to read between the lines about what they're saying about certain things. So Warren Kinsella, who was one of the journalists who broke a few of the news stories surrounding Me Too, he retweeted Kristen Raworth's story about Kent Hare that gained a lot of traction. Now, he mentioned that there would be more allegations that would be revealed to the public. He wrote on his blog that, quote, "There are other men who are about to be exposed. One of these men is very, very powerful. The stories have been known about him for 3 years. They are in affidavits, plural. His name will shock you." Now, Trudeau was asked about this as well in that same interview, and he said that he had no idea who that person might be. So it's kind of hard not to wade into political gossip about this, but let's do some digging. I'll just put the info out there, and I'll let you listeners decide whether it's true or not. So in the comment section of Kinsella's blog was an approved comment by someone named Matt. In the comment, Matt had this to say, "If it's the same person who I've been told has multiple sworn affidavits against him, you can't get bigger in Canada. I know one of the people whose signatures is on one of the affidavits. This person has told me the contents of the affidavits. Explosive doesn't even begin to describe it. I will not repeat what I was told here because I haven't personally seen them, and even if I had, I don't want to make any legal trouble for Warren. What I will say is, if they do get out, they will destroy this person's very carefully crafted public image and reputation." Now, when he was asked who that might be, if they could give a hint, Matt only replied with, "He likes themed socks." Now, it's hard to tell whether that story is true or not. As with any comment section, you never really know, especially when it comes to politics. But that's the nature of these accusations. In a lot of cases, they're just he said, she said stories, and they can't be definitively proven one way or another. However, Kinsella just last week broke a news story that he had found in the Creston Valley Advance that was about Justin Trudeau. Now, the editorial is from August 14th, 2000, and we all know that was just after the turn of the millennium, quite a long time ago, back when Trudeau wasn't an MP, and he was just the son of a former prime minister. Now, he claims that, that editorial claims that Trudeau was in Creston to celebrate the Kokanee Summit Festival, and that he apologized a day late for, quote, "inappropriately handling," or what the editorial calls groping, a young female reporter who was working for the Creston Valley Advance and also reporting for the Vancouver Sun and National Post. Now, he was alleged to have said, "I'm sorry, if I had known you were reporting for a national paper, I would never have been so forward." You have to ask yourself, what does that mean? Why does her job matter? Was it only because she was now in a position to embarrass him that he was sorry that he did it? And now the editorial ends with, "Shouldn't the son of a former prime minister be aware of the rights and wrongs that go along with public socializing?" A story that was published earlier, a couple days before in the Advanced, was entitled "Mixed Reaction to Camp Kokanee" on August 10th. Now, details were about the festival's party-like atmosphere with plenty of drinking and dancing to live music. However, one woman was quoted anonymously as saying, quote, "It wasn't a good place to be if you're female," saying that she was touched several times inappropriately. Now, since then, this whole story about Justin Trudeau has been picked up by BuzzFeed, The Sun UK, The Daily Telegraph, Breitbart, and Narcity. Now, even the New York Times made mentions of it. Notice that all these are online or out-of-country media outlets. There are no newspapers outside of the Toronto Sun, where it was talked about by Mark Bonokowski and Brian Lilly. No Canadian TV networks have talked about this. No radio networks have talked about it. There's really next to no Canadian coverage at all about this. Now remember, these allegations were out there on the evening of Wednesday, June the 6th. Trudeau spoke to the media on the Thursday and the Friday before the G7, but he didn't face any questions about this. He didn't get questioned on this at the G7 closing news conference, and when he got back to the Ottawa, Trudeau was also able to speak to the media on the Tuesday and the Wednesday, and he again wasn't questioned about this whatsoever. In fact, we don't really have any comment on this from the PMO. Now, as Brian Lilly writes, there's a study in ignoring a major news story that is sitting right in front of them. When Patrick Brown faced allegations, every media outlet jumped on them. When Rick Dextra faced allegations, the same thing happened. When the Liberal MPs were all named, they were all covered extensively as well. So, however, when it comes to Trudeau, the media is silent. And as we all know, when the media is silent on a major issue, that means there's another story going on that we don't know about.
Wow. Okay. Let's just recap this here, that this is an allegation regarding the Prime Minister of Canada. We listed off BuzzFeed, The Sun UK, The Daily Telegraph, Breitbart, Narcity, and The New York Times. All made mention of it. The only place it was mentioned in Canada was the Toronto Sun, online, and this podcast. Why?
It really begs the question. If there is a story here, you would think that the journalists would want to talk about it to try and verify if it's true or not. But it seems like the only people that are talking about it are, of course, Warren Kinsella, who first brought it up. And, you know, even then it was kind of veiled. You had to read between the lines on it. Brian Lilly was the only one to actually bring it to everyone's attention. And other than that, there's really been nothing about it at all. Yeah, I mean, if you don't go to those news sources, no one would have heard about it.
If there are signed affidavits regarding this case, as the blog post alleges, that is the same level of plausibility that the Patrick Brown allegations have. And let's look where Patrick Brown is today.
Yeah, because there were signed affidavits about Patrick Brown as well, and everyone seemed to know about them too. But in this case, we hear nothing about it. And, so it's really quite something.
And let's also not forget the link. He enjoys themed socks.
Mm-hmm. I know, right? So, I mean, in Canada, there's no more powerful than you can get than the top dog. And of course, in this case, that would be Trudeau, the Prime Minister. So, and it's very interesting how people back then, the theme socks thing about Trudeau wasn't really that known, but since then we've had the India trip, we've had a bunch of different occasions where Trudeau's had his socks out, and well, there you go, right? I mean, it's just baffling how the media has not been talking about this whatsoever. I mean, it might not be true. We can give him that benefit of the doubt. It might not be true. It might be true.
And we said the same thing with really Patrick know. Brown as well.
Exactly.
And Kent Hare.
We don't know it.
And Darshan Kang. We said the same thing with all of them. So, you know, there are times on this podcast in general where I feel the response to a story is natural. There have been very few segments on the show where I am at a loss for words about what to say about a story just because of how massive we can make these firing line segments be. And this is one of those days. So I think we should just leave this for the listeners to interpret as they see fit. I mean, all the information is there, and I think it's quite clear about what's happening.
Exactly. So. And, yeah, that's all we can really say about that is if there is something there, the media should be talking about it. And they should be trying to verify if it's true or not.
All right. What do we got for Word of the Week?
So Word of the Week this week is actually going to be backbencher, and that is described as a member of parliament or a legislative assembly who does not hold office in the government or in the opposition and who sits behind the front benches in the House of Commons. So in this case, it would be someone who isn't either in cabinets, they aren't in shadow cabinets, and they're not really a part of any government office other than being an MP. So in this case, the backbencher that we described was Leonard Krogh, who we have to remember that backbenchers don't really hold that much sway with the government. A lot of government's decisions are just made by cabinet. But when there's a razor-thin majority, like we have with the NDP and Greens in BC, backbenchers actually hold a lot of sway because there's less leeway for the government to be able to discipline them.
Especially a very small majority or minority like you have in BC. So
indeed.
And we also have the case of Maxime Bernier being moved from Shadow Cabinet to Backmatcher over supply management after he won last year, he lost last year against Andrew Shearer by, I think it was around 1.5 percentage points. It was a very slim victory for Shearer, and here we are a year later. Due to supply management, Bernier is in the backbenches once again. So.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that he hasn't been for quite some time as well. He's been pretty prominent. He's been one of the most reelected conservative MPs from Quebec. So to see him in the backbenches is definitely quite surprising. But it's all due to what power the leader has and what cabinet has.
That's right. All right. So if you guys want full show notes for this episode, including our picture of the week, which is of the article from August 2000, you can find all that at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast and any number of podcast listeners, iTunes, Google Play Music, Pocket Cast, you name it. You can find out how to do that at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we post all the stories of the week that we're looking at, that we're considering, that might indeed make it onto the show. So with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure that we cut out all of that bias and sensationalism that you see in the mainstream media and make sure that you get the news with the right context that you need to put you on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.